Are you familiar with the idea of death as an advisor?
No, I'm not, so tell me a bit.
It's from Carlos Castaneda.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but keep going. I know Castaneda's books, at least the early ones, but remind me.
Yeah, it was in the third one, I think. It was one of, like, four basic principles. There was erasing personal history.
Right.
There was losing self-importance. There was disrupting routines. And
okay.
Then there was using death as an advisor, and I think that last one was the most crucial. And the... I don't advocate Castaneda per se. I say in my mystical years, I was completely, he was my Bible, but now I would say approach with caution, and just as fictional narratives, they have some very meaningful kind of models in there, and this being one of them. The basic premise was that death is constantly with us,
right?
And that we can at any time turn to it and refer to it and listen to it, and what it will tell us, well, one of the main things it will tell us anyway, is that whatever we're wrestling with right now, whatever's triggering us, whatever is causing us anxiety, whatever is seeming some insoluble problem or meaningful, whatever it is, we can turn to death and ask death, and death will say, it ain't nothing.
Yeah.
Because it's not me.
Right.
So, in other words, and on top of that, the very worst that can happen is death, and that is the one thing we know for sure is going to happen. But also, at any given point, except the point where it is happening, of course, we can see that it's not happening.
Right.
So it's the contextualizer.
Yeah, and now I remember, and thanks for reminding me. I was also a big fan of Castaneda in my youth. I was a little disenchanted when when it became evident that it was clever fiction as opposed to anthropology. But be that as it may, there's some fine ideas in Castaneda. I like one of my favorite lines. I can't remember which book is. When Don Juan says the average person seeks approval in the eyes of others and calls it self-confidence, where the warrior seeks approval in his own eyes and calls it humility. I thought that was very cool. But the idea of death as an advisor, now that you reminded me, that has historic roots. I mean, that's why the ancients and in the Middle Ages, the monks would like work with the skulls on their desk. Just the idea to keep in mind our ultimate fate and point out the contrast between death and the fact that if we're there looking at it metaphorically and literally, that we're not yet dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as I say, if we can hold awareness of death, if we can hold the idea of death in our awareness, at least to some extent, it does reduce any other anxieties to piffle.
That's correct.
And that is liberating.
Yes, I think so.
Because, I mean, we don't have to be anxious about death now. I mean, this is the thing Castaneda had trouble with, as he recounted it. He kept saying, well, I can't think about death the whole time. That would just be morbid and
right.
It would make me anxious. And so it took a while for him to understand that there's a way to think about death that doesn't increase anxiety but actually reduces it.
Yes.
And I would guess that's what you guys are working with your terror management.
Yes, well, that's at least what we've been wrestling with lately. The idea we've kind of globbed onto, it's another Camus one. I guess in his notebooks he scribbled on the side, come to terms with death. Thereafter, everything is possible. And I think that's a pithy statement that's in accord with what we've been talking about the last few moments.
Right. And in your own life, is there a way that you could describe how that's happening, if it is happening?
Well, all right, that's an awesome query. I'd like to think I've done my best to come to terms with my own death in ways that make me live better. I mean, I tried all the things that, or I've tried to try all the things that don't work all that well, fondness for drugs and alcohol, preoccupation with stuff, and kind of, as Kierkegaard put it, tranquilizing ourselves with the trivial. Mm-hmm. And then there's other things that, to me, are more rewarding and, I hope, less futile in the negative sense of the word. I love music, even though I'm bad at it. I've been playing the same three chords badly for years. And I love our pets. I love our children. I love plants. I love walking around and partaking of the moment. And so I guess I'm a work in progress, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Does it relate, and this is, now it's going to be a leading question because I can't resist, but does it relate to being in your body in some way, to being more aware of your bodily experience?
I think so. I don't know where I would be in the kind of materialist, spiritual, mystical continuum. But I do see myself as an embodied, ephemeral creature, and I think a lot has to do with for myself becoming comfortable with the carcass in which I'm currently ensconced.
Right. Well, that's the reason I had to ask that question, because that's been my experience, that death. I mean, the body doesn't seem to be afraid of death, I mean, except when it's happening. I'm sure
right.
There's adrenaline that gets released if a lion's coming after us, but it may be the opposite. If it's some inescapable death, the body will release chemicals to ease that experience, I think. I mean, wasn't it Livingston was attacked by a lion and mauled by a lion, and he described experience as blissful?
That's right.
So I imagine that was some chemical reaction in the body there, you know, kicking in, because what else can you do, right? So the mind of course can wrestle with death forever and the terror of it, and there may be a purpose to that, more than one, but certainly the one we've touched upon with using death as an advisor, and terror as a kind of awakening. It brings us into the moment, certainly, but in terms of being more in tune with my body, there does seem to be an innate acceptance in the body of just reality, I suppose. Acceptance isn't the word, actually, but I'm fumbling for words at this point. I had the same experience with Doug, and he accused me of religious thinking because I was just trying to describe a very peaceful experience of being in the body that seemed to transcend all mental constructs,
right,
and interpretations and the desire for meaning. It just is.
Again, well put. And, one of my favorite philosophers, and now dead, a woman named Suzanne Langer, writes in very much similar terms. The body is it's a biological system that is designed by billions of years of evolution to have a so-called natural life that involves a beginning and an end, and it just moves quite devoid of any apprehension through that process, and come what may.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the birds and the bees.
Right.
I was born skinny and slapped down flat, been worn thin as hell's welcome mat. There's a hole punched through my middle that will likely start to crack. My head is spinning at 78. The needle arm has sealed my fate. I'm dead too soon and born too late. I best be headed back. So bury me in shellac. Bury me in shellac. I don't want to walk no lonesome valley. So when I die, won't you be a pally and dump my body in Tin Pan Alley? Bury me in shellac.
There's not very many podcasts of you. There's not much audio material of you. There's a lot of videos.
That's right.
I couldn't find too many audios to listen to. And one of the few I could find was an NPR thing on the ticker, that watch that they were marketing a while back that counts down to your death, your alleged death or your estimated death. Do you have one of those, by the way?
No, I don't.
Yeah. So one of the things that struck me, and we touched on this last time to some extent, but was how you said maybe it would work in terms of making people happy and more appreciative of life and whatnot, or maybe not. And you talked about how, yes, on the one hand, it helps bring people into the moment and more appreciative of being alive and of all the rest of it, but on the other hand, it triggers this, all of these, this unconscious fear and this hostility and these compensatory compulsive activities and all the rest of it. So I was curious about that, in terms of, in your research, if you've discovered a sort of a factor that determines which way it goes there.
Well, yes and no. Good question. You know, what we do know is that it literally depends on the extent to which one's contemplation of mortality is conscious and sustained. And so, you know, like all the great religions and the philosophers since antiquity who point out that, you know, if you can really squarely come to terms with your own mortality, that ought to bring the best out in us by rendering us both humble as well as grateful, and consequently, as you put it earlier, to be more directly rooted in the moment and partaking of life, you know, as we encounter it, you know, rather than dwelling on the past and perseverating on the future, you know, and in so doing, pissing away the present. And so that would be, you know, with regard to the death watch or anything like that, that would be a good outcome. Right, but non-optimal outcomes, we would argue based on our research, would be the result of just a chain of unconscious defensive reactions that are instigated by fleeting reminders of death. And so what we know is that, you know, for example, if you walk past a cemetery, you might not even realize that death is on your mind. But we do know that non-conscious ruminations about death do tend to engender, for example, hostility towards people who are different or a preoccupation with conspicuous consumption. And so under those conditions, we would propose, based on our research, that's when non-optimal outcomes would arise. So in one sense, that's my superficial response to your question, which is that it depends on the character of one's musing about death. Is it, you know, basically passive and fleeting, or is it really very explicitly conscious and sustained? But I don't think that addresses, nor am I in a position to respond to, what I sense is kind of the deeper question, which is, okay, given what I said, if that's true, then, you know, under what conditions, or what kinds of people are more likely to go the more productive route, if that makes any sense?
Yeah. Yeah, because what you've described, from what I got from what you described, the main factor is whether it's consciously raised and whether a person is allowed to consciously contemplate death as opposed to just being made aware of it unconsciously, and therefore it sort of festers in
yes.
the unconscious. But I mean, is that to say that in your research that there really is a line there between if you actually bring up death, directly and say, we're going to talk about death now, as compared to when you just slip it in subliminally, that's right. What you're saying, that determines, that's one of the factors that determines the difference.
Yes, that's very true. So what we do know from our research is that, you know, when people are reminded of death, and, you know, quite consciously, when we give them a questionnaire, for example, when we ask them, all right, describe your thoughts and feelings associated with dying, well, if you do that, then the first thing that happens, in our research at least, is that people, whether they're aware of it or not, try and banish those death thoughts from consciousness. So that's what I mean when I said earlier that, you know, even conscious reminders of death tend to start this chain of events to, first of all, remove death thoughts from consciousness, and then to keep them from returning. And that's what produces all of the negative or unfortunate defensive reactions. But we haven't in our research yet, and this is perhaps to our discredit, although we're getting there, just now we're trying to think about, well, okay, how do we foster these more conscious, more sustained, more active confrontations with mortality to produce more favorable outcomes, both in terms of for the benefit of the individual and society writ large? I mean, without sounding defensive, the point that we generally make, Jason, is that, you know, our original concern based on Becker's ideas was to understand how come people can't get along all that well with folks who are different. And so most of our research for the past 30 years has been to understand the more unsavory aspects of human affairs. And now we're kind of at a point where we're like, okay, we think we have established to our satisfaction and to other scholars the merits of Becker's claims to the effect that death denial produces a host of unfortunate outcomes. And so now we kind of want to turn this around and say, all right, death is not going to go away, or at least I don't think it is in our lifetime. And so given that state of affairs, you know, how do we kind of follow Camus' advice when he says, come to terms with death, thereafter anything is possible?
Right. So you started with the negative manifestations of that.
And that's right. And, you know, even Ernest Becker, when he was dying in the 1970s, 73 or 74, I think, and he's being interviewed by Sam Keen, on his deathbed, literally a day or two before he dies. And one of the questions that came up was, well, you know, aren't you being one-sided and negative in your assessment of the way that people are and in the role that death awareness plays in human activities? And Becker kind of said the same thing, which is, yeah, I get that. But there's plenty of people that are looking at the more positive aspects of human behavior. And so I just want to kind of level the psychological playing field. And I guess that's how we felt at the time, too.
Mm. Yeah, I think, I mean, that's my approach, too, in terms of exploring anything. I like to explore the dark side of society, parapolitics, and things like that, and systemic abuse. And it just seems that it's a great way to study the organism, is to look at how the ways in which it goes wrong.
That's right. Yeah. And by the way, that's not necessarily a cynical or, you know, it's or nihilistic view of things. I think it was Thomas Hardy, the British novelist, who said, if a way to the better there be, it comes from taking a close look at the worst. Yeah. And that's the little epigraph that Ernest Becker used at the start of his last book, Escape from Evil. And so I see no harm in that approach.
Yeah, I loved that saying. I felt I could be my own sort of,
yeah, me too,
maxim there. So I'm just going to linger from that on just sort of practical machinery, because I'm just curious about this and I don't want to overlook the details. The research that you've done, I mean, one of the things, as long as we're talking about the negative, is that the people in your research, as you've discovered, that when people are insinuated or incepted with the idea of death, they're more likely to be willing to hurt other people.
That's right.
So how exactly have you tested that?
Good question, rather. We've done so in a variety of ways. I think one of the most direct and because of it, somewhat disheartening demonstrations, Jason, came from what we call the hot sauce paradigm. Are you familiar with the Milgram experiments where people think they're shocking other folks who aren't learning?
Yeah.
Well, so, you know, that's pretty much the most famous experiment in the history of social psychology to measure aggression. People are brought into the lab, and they think they're trying to teach another participant how to learn things, and every time the participant supposedly makes an error, they're supposed to administer an electrical shock, and the shock, the voltage gets higher. Until the person on the other end stops responding. Now, there is no person on the other end, and all that Milgram wanted to demonstrate was how much the average person would hurt a fellow human being just to comply with the orders of someone in authority.
So you mean that they didn't have an actor on the other end? There was no sound effects?
There was an actor, and there were sound effects, but they weren't really shocking anybody.
Okay.
And so what Milgram found was that, you know, if you ask people, if you were in this situation, would you keep shocking somebody? And 90% of the people said, no, I would stop. But in the actual experiment, I think it was two-thirds of the participants ended up administering what would have been lethal electrical shocks. And so that's kind of the gold standard in a laboratory setting. And so our first inclination was to say, all right, maybe we should use this shock paradigm. But the problem is that every college student or college-educated person on Earth, or at least in North America, let's say, is aware of that paradigm. So we had to come up with another approach. And what we did happened quite by accident. I was teaching at the University of Arizona, and where there's a lot of Mexican food. And we saw an article in the newspaper at the time about a cook at a Denny's, I think, in Vermont or New Hampshire, who laced police officers' eggs with Tabasco. And the police officers got, like, second-degree burns, which was kind of funny. But anyway, they arrested the cook. And then we learned that hot sauce has been used in many a felonious assault. And so this gave us an idea, which was to use salsa, very hot salsa, as a means of aggression. And so we designed a study, and it's kind of, the details are kind of complex, but basically what happened is people came into the lab and they thought it was a taste testing experiment and that they were going to work with another participant. And they learned that the other participant didn't like spicy foods. And then they also learned that the other participant either agreed with their political views or disagreed with their political views vehemently. And then, like a lot of our studies, some people were reminded of their mortality, and other people were reminded of something unpleasant but not fatal. And then what happened is that the participants were told, hey, here's this very hot salsa, and you're going to give your partner as much or as little of the salsa as you'd like, and they're going to have to eat it and then rate its qualities. And remember, you already learned that this person doesn't like spicy food. And what we were interested in is how much hot sauce our participants would give to their supposed partner, depending upon whether they had been reminded of their mortality and whether the person agreed with their political beliefs. And what we found was, in my opinion, quite astonishing, and that is that under control conditions, it didn't matter whether the person, whether the supposed partner agreed with you or not, the people doled out a modest amount of hot sauce. But when the participants were reminded of mortality, their own mortality, that is, And when the person they were giving the hot sauce to disagreed with their political beliefs, then they gave them twice as much. And when we debriefed the participants and we said, wow, did you realize that the other person was going to have to eat all this? The participants were quite aware that they were literally dosing their partners with what was going to be a very unpleasant experience. But what they had no idea of was that it was the death reminder that was provoking the more aggressive response.
So bury me in shellac, bury me in shellac. Don't plant me in some wormy mound. My plan for eternal life is sound. The cycle keeps on spinning round. Bury me in shellac. There's a wooden box back in the corner. The lid is open to greet the mourner. Just turn the crank and hear the horn and view me dressed in black. But when the needle stops its glide, don't think it means my soul has flied. For we'll meet again on the other side of my memorial plaque. Oh, bury me in shellac, bury me in shellac. Let me go on record and testify, and make my last request if I could best be laid to rest, if I be buried in shellac.
I hope that makes sense. So that was one way that we showed that death reminders make you more likely to harm others if they disagree with you. Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes perfect sense. And it puts, it assuages some of my concerns about, and partly why I asked the question, to be frank, was because in the electroshock test, I mean, one question I would have for anyone who performed those experiments was wouldn't they be concerned about the psychological effect it would have on the subjects who actually thought that they were torturing people?
Right.
That seems like that's a very, that needs to be considered as well. So you brought it to a much more kind of everyday and much less extreme dimension seems to be a much healthier approach.
Well, that's right. So we were trying to be mindful. Now, of course, the Milgram shock paradigm has the virtue of being more brutal, but it's also brutal in terms of, you know, when we think of aggression, shock is probably a more close to real life pain than hot sauce. But the hot sauce paradigm has been used, in 8 or 10 other experiments and has been validated by being highly related to other punitive responses. But so that's one way that we've shown that death reminders make people more inclined to be hurtful. Another way is through other experiments. And so I can't remember if we spoke about this last time, and forgive me if we have, but we did some work with an Iranian psychologist in 2004 or 5, where we had Iranians either reminded of death or something unpleasant, and then we asked them how much they supported suicide bombing and how much they might want to become a suicide bomber. Did we talk about that last time around?
No.
All right, so this is good. And so what we found is that under control conditions, Iranians were not supportive of suicide bombing. They call it martyrdom activity, nor were they quite understandably inclined to volunteer to become a suicide bomber. However, after being reminded of their mortality, they were much more supportive of suicide bombing and much more willing to sign up to become a suicide bomber. And that's quite ominous if you think about it. But if you think that this is something that has to do with Iranians or being exotic or Islamic, another group of researchers did a study with British participants and asked them after a death reminder or not, how much they would be willing to sacrifice their lives in the service of protecting their country. And they got the same outcome. Under control conditions, the Brits were not overly enthusiastic about becoming martyrs, but they were much more willing to do so when they were reminded of death. And then at the same time that we did the Iranian study, we did a parallel study in the U.S., and this time around, we asked Americans to either think about dying or something unpleasant, and then we asked them how much they supported the use of biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons against countries who pose no direct threat to us. And we found the same kind of, on the one hand, encouraging outcome. And what I mean by encouraging is that in control conditions, Americans were staunch in their opposition to the preemptive use of weapons of mass destruction against countries who pose no threat to us. But on the other hand, when they were reminded of their mortality first, they became considerably more supportive of the use of weapons of mass destruction. And this was particularly true of Americans who identify as conservatives.
Have you factored in or thought much about the use of entertainment media as a way to, I mean, simply put, as a form of propaganda, but is kind of obvious, and the way that Hollywood and mainstream American TV and other, not just American, but creates these narratives which are filled with death and violence, but also embedded with the dominant values of the culture. Have you thought about this, the connection between using that media as a way to trigger people's death anxiety and then prompt them to, you know, joining the army? And
we've not done that, but other folks are in the process, and I think this will be very important work. I mean, I think for the most part, sociologists are in agreement, as are psychologists, that, you know, the popular media at any time is kind of a caricature of a stereotype of prevailing cultural values, and it shouldn't surprise us, therefore, if we see the dominant concerns of any given historical era manifest in, you know, what's in the movies and on the social media. But the point that you make, which is to what extent does exposure to the media trigger thoughts of death? And what happens thereafter? There's some very clever folks that both in Canada and in the U.S. that are now concerned with these issues. And a lot of this work is in process. And so there's some teams of researchers that are interested in video games and to what extent video games are used to both arouse as well as to mollify death anxiety. And there's other folks that are interested in, like, smartphones. You know how some people are addicted to their devices and they get anxious even if they can't find their phone for an hour or two. Right. And based on our ideas, people are hypothesizing that, you know, just the technology that we're surrounded by is essentially just basically pieces of equipment that serve to buffer existential concerns.
Right. Yeah, it seems like there's a real can of worms there, to put it mildly, in terms
yes.
of how, you know, capitalism needs to constantly create consumers and create products for them to consume and so on, and the whole machinery of that, and how you've pointed out how death anxiety drives people to consume, to seek distractions in objects and exterior possessions. So, like, the way that that could be used consciously or otherwise to fuel the industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
But while at the same time triggering much more destructive impulses.
That's right.
Which would then fuel the war engine.
Yeah, brilliant. And I happen to agree. At the risk of sounding, you know, like kind of a Marxist throwback to the Woodstock days. But Marx may have been a crappy economist, but he was a great psychologist, and he understood, he understood a few things. One, with regard to what you said a moment ago, is that capitalism can only function if people buy more and more stuff. As Marx pointed out, if people just bought what they wanted and needed, any market-based economy would collapse in a matter of hours. And I think one of Marx's most profound insights is that in a capitalist society, you have to create desires that may not be there intrinsically. And the best way to create a desire is to render people anxious for things that they don't have. And so what a lot of folks have proposed, and here basically Becker is a big fan of another guy named Norman Brown, who wrote a book called Life Against Death.
Yeah, it's a great book.
And that's what Norman Brown says, is look, we don't have to like this, but, capitalism is basically, there's an inexorable logic, and, to keep capitalism alive, metaphorically, we need people to buy more and more stuff, and to get people to buy more and more stuff, we need to convince them that they want and need things that they don't really want and need. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, we have to arouse death anxiety, whether we're aware of it or not. And when we do that, people will indeed buy more and more stuff, but it also makes them more vicious and stupid in other ways, including being cavalierly either indifferent or hostile to the natural environment.
Right. So would you say that the sexual component of advertising, that's part of the rationale for that?
Is
that?
Oh, absolutely.
Trigger people's libido, and that will have a corresponding sort of stirring up of the death anxiety.
That's right.
Just sat in my room and stared at the ceiling, convinced I was doomed. Digging up memories and trying to make sense of the bloodthirsty sequence of recent events. And every damn time the conclusion's the same. I know it's my fault, yeah, I know I'm to blame. It's so typical, it's a habit of mine, a cyclical relapse. Time after time, and am I too stupid? Am I doomed to repeat in heartbreaking detail every single defeat? Am I too ugly? Am I too dumb to ever sit and reflect on the things that I've done? The stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, they never really ring true. So
on violence in movies, it's the first thing I published back in 1999, called The Blood Poets, and towards the end I talked about this whole question of to what extent the media representations of violence actually see people with, to what extent do they lead to actual behaviours. And it felt at that time, I'm not sure where it is now, as though that idea had kind of been dismissed. It seemed
right.
As though it got hijacked by the Christians, like so many other good ideas, and somehow dumbed down to the point where intelligent thinking, liberal people just dismissed it as ridiculous.
Right.
So what I posited back then was that it's not just the violence, it's a combination. I was talking about TV particularly, but this would fit with movies as well, because they often sort of introduced as product placement and all the rest of it, but that a combination of the advertising, which has this sexual content, subliminal or otherwise, while at the same time marketing these dumb products in a way that kind of insults the viewer, like says, this is what's wrong with you and this is going to fix it. And yes, of course, it's a very it's a subtle kind of demeaning that's going on in advertising, I would say. And that, so my idea was that combined with stirring up people's sexual desire and then saying, if you want to satisfy your sexual desire, you need to drink Budweiser or you need, yes, to use this aftershave, that would trigger a corresponding anger and hostility. And then after the commercial break's over, then you have whatever 25 deaths in the next 30 minutes or whatever the stats are, and then that sort of prescribes the sort of behavior that this is what you can do with that violent, that anger that's been stirred up in you unconsciously. Here's the behaviors that are going to resolve it. So that was my hypothesis anyway, that it wasn't just the violence, but a combination of violence with advertising, i.e. the capitalist drive or the capitalist, you know, propaganda combined using the sexual, yeah, stimulation.
Yeah, good idea. I like that.
I put it in the book and that was the end of it. Nobody picked it up, but it's just coming to me now after all these years. It's quite, don't you find it quite overwhelming sometimes when you look at just the complexity of this, and as you said before, the sort of, I can't remember the phrase you used, but just how endemic it is, the whole thing. I mean, just how how long it's been going on and just how prevalent it is and how much a part of our psyche at this point, that culture, you know? I mean, we're talking about the culture, we're not just talking about a capitalist conspiracy, yeah, but the whole sort of cultural fabric that we've been spawned by.
That's right.
Do you find it overwhelming at times? Cause I certainly,
yeah, it is overwhelming and a little disconcerting because, you're right, it's part and parcel of the cultural fabric, and as you put it, we're all enmeshed in it, whether we're aware of it or not, you know, for better and worse, and it's sometimes hard to imagine how we can extricate ourselves from it before the culture implodes on itself. I mean, as a lot of folks have pointed out, you know, the crazy guy Oswald Spengler and the decline of the West, or the Jared Diamond, the guy who wrote Guns, Germs, and Steel, he wrote another book called Collapse, How Societies Choose to Fail or Succeed. And, you know, most cultures don't wake up proverbially and kind of consciously and reflectively survey their problems and extricate themselves from them. You know, quite the contrary, most just literally either exhaust their natural resources or exhaust themselves fighting with other people, and the culture just kind of peters out. And I'd like to be wrong on this one, but it is hard to imagine at this point. Mm. How things will change.
Yeah, well, I think petering out would be a kind of optimistic outcome.
There you go.
What do you think about transhumanism? I mean, as far as how real it is and how much that describes the future of, you know, our children, if we have any. I don't. But,
you know, I don't know. You know, there's a couple of flavors of transhumanism that I'm vaguely aware of. Are you just referring to the idea that we're going to be fine without humans?
No, I haven't heard that definition. This Ray Kurzweil is the main proponent here.
Right.
I was going to say perpetrator, but as far as propagating the ideas of transhumanism, so basically it's the idea that we can and must continue to exist or evolve beyond the merely human using technology to
do so.
Oh,
I see.
Right. So, I mean, you mentioned in your book, which I haven't got, by the way, but I do, that Alex Gray, and he's kind of a transhumanist, but I think from what I know about Alex de Grey, is I think the name, right?
Yeah, or Aubrey, I think.
Oh, Aubrey de Grey, okay. Yeah. Alex de Grey, is an artist, I think. Anyway, Aubrey de Grey is, I think, from what I know about him, he's more about life extension, in terms of keeping the body alive longer. So that's sort of the thin end of the wedge of transhumanism, whereas the thick end is the singularity, and this is that we will eventually, through a combination of nanotechnology and cybernetics and whatever, we will be able to translate ourselves from the physical into either into hardware or into just code, and then we'll continue to exist as pure digital data.
Well, okay, yeah, now I get it. We write about that in our book, and we're being kind of silly, but not when, you know, we say, all right, right now when most people get done doing things, you know, it doesn't count till they post it on their Facebook page. And, you know, so what's going to happen when you don't have a body anymore and you are your Facebook page? I don't know. To me, and again, with all due respect to the people who take this idea seriously, it's hard for me not to just see this as, a somewhat thinly veiled effort to deny one's own mortality by embracing the magic of technology. And I'm not sure if it's desirable, Jason, and I'm certainly not sure if it would work. I can't remember where I saw this. It may have been like National Geographic, or it was certainly, some kind of scholarly publication where someone pointed out that, we're assuming that in the digital age of computers, that if you want to keep something, you should scan the image as opposed to like having a piece of papyrus that's been sitting in some library for 3,000 years. Hmm. And yet what the author of this article pointed out is that, there are pieces of paper that are 3,000 years old and we still have them,
right.
But it's quite possible that in 100 years, if you have something stored on a hard drive, it might be completely inaccessible to the extent that the technology has changed. Like a floppy disk of yesteryear?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have one of those, most likely you can't do anything with it unless you have an old-fashioned device that can read it.
Right.
So, what happens to transhumanism if everybody's uploaded on a computer cloud and then there's some ginormous accident and it's not backed up? Well, you're doomed to oblivion in the same way that one might be when your body conks out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to feel you're walking on eggs with me, Sheldon, because personally I think the whole thing is deeply, deeply insane.
Okay, good.
But I am curious about it. I mean, because it does seem that some seemingly very intelligent people and powerful people are pushing this agenda, and it does seem to be becoming more and more the new religion, I suppose would be the simplest way to put it.
Then we agree, and I'm not saying this simply because we agree, Jason, but I was a little bit restrained in the service of not being patently offensive. But, I think it's delusional. And I think it has become the new religion. And I feel the same way about the so-called big data fetish, this idea that in part propagated by Google, that if we just have enough information, that will translate into infinite power and infinite duration.
Right. So it's the same old drive.
So. That's correct. It's no different than the alchemist quest. It's a different form of the same ancient yearning to transcend death.
Right. So this is kind of why I said if the culture petered out, that would be the best case scenario. Because to me, the worst case scenario would be that somehow we find new energy resources and are able to continue with this insane transhumanist dream, and actually eventually we will just become code and our bodies and our psyches will be floating somewhere in limbo, completely forgotten. And then the middle case would be a great upheaval, convulsion, where the whole dominant culture collapses because there's nothing to prop it up, and that would seem to be more likely to me. The petering out is kind of hard to imagine, just because there's so many people there that it would just be, I mean, a massive amount of suffering one way or another, I think.
Yeah, I want to disagree with you, and I hope that we're wrong, but I can't. I mean, when I talk to the students here at Skidmore where I teach, and, you know, I maybe I'm being a little polemic, but I'm just like, you know, on our present course, you know, you'll be disemboweling your neighbor for a carrot or a drink of water. It may very well make, you know, Mel Gibson films seem like Disney movies.
Yeah.
For too many years, I dug the same hole. I lost my ambition and buried my soul. I convinced myself I was a useless mess, so deserving of my lack of success. But on a good day, I can finally see it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's typical, yeah, it's a habit of mine, but I'm breaking that cycle a step at a time. And I'm not that stupid, I'm not doomed to repeat in heartbreaking detail every single defeat. And I may be ugly and I may be dumb, but I sit and reflect on the things that I've done. The stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, they never really ring true. So how about we tear them up and start anew? The stories we tell.
Pull back, because as I said, it's quite overwhelming when we sort of try and take in the whole large picture. And one of the things that is characteristic of how I approach stuff is to try and use all this as a mirror for understanding my own inner dynamics, my own inner complexes and configurations, because I feel that's the only thing that I can do anything about, and the only thing I need to address really is that. And I think there is a match, like if we look at the pathologies driving the culture and that are embedded in the culture or inseparable from it, they do reflect naturally our own inner pathologies one way or another. And so are you familiar with Danny Brower, I think his name is?
Yes, I am.
I figured you would. Do you want to... Are you familiar enough with it to sum it up for us so I don't have to?
Well, are we talking about Danny Brower, the geneticist?
Yeah, so the biology of denial.
Ajit Varghese and Danny Brower wrote Denial, although Brower's no longer alive, I understand. Their views, I think, are completely in accord with ours. Specifically, what they argue is that full-blown... self-consciousness, you know, which is a hallmark of our humanity, you know, specifically the capacity to be aware of ourselves and aware of that awareness, juxtaposed with what they call mental time travel, you know, which is just not only being aware of yourself, but to be able to metaphorically move yourself around in time. You know, imagine yourself, tap dancing on the Great Wall of China 3,000 years ago, or to anticipate what it might be like, you know, in the middle of Manhattan 2,000 years from now. What Varkey and Brouwer hypothesize is that humans could never have become fully conscious without the concurrent emergence of sophisticated mechanisms of death denial, because without them, self-awareness would have been an evolutionary liability. They hypothesized that our ancestors would literally have died of overwhelming anxiety and or despair. And so that's their view, as I understand it, is that what a lot of evolutionary psychology types, people like Steven Pinker or Daniel Dennett or Richard Dawkins, they all declare supernatural beliefs, for example, to be just non-adaptive byproducts of other cognitive adaptations. And what Brouwer and Varkey are saying is, no, that's, you're really missing the point, that supernatural beliefs and religious beliefs were fundamental adaptations that allowed our ancestors to become fully conscious. And, you know, so the way we describe it in the book, we say something along the lines of, you know, there couldn't have been calculus without grave goods, and there may never have been dentists without the tooth fairy.
Right. So that's back to how culture is created through this sort of dissociative fantasy.
That's correct. For us, it's an idea that we embrace, but it is kind of a minority position still in the academic atmosphere.
And this would be at the roots of why culture is so destructive, then, because if it begins with some sort of dissociative fantasy, eventually it ends up as that.
That's correct. In fact, this Geza Roheim, who's one of Freud's disciples, anthropologist, he said, and people were pissed at the time, but in the early part of the 20th century, he just said civilization is a giant projection by what he described humans as a baby that's afraid of the dark.
Or afraid of being abandoned.
And none of this, by the way, Jason, implies that there aren't, and I don't think you're implying this at all, but this is not to suggest that culture is one-sided in terms of being infantile and or destructive, because it certainly organizes human beings and allows them to share symbol systems that have tremendous generative capacity, and no one's disputing that. We're just saying, and I sense that you're agreeing, that there's necessarily a downside in that the original impetus for the formation of what we call culture or civilization was fundamentally defensive, and that was to ward off death anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm forever returning to this, like the origin of whatever we're talking about, the culture in this case, the origin of ego, the origin of self-awareness, the origin of violence, the origin of... it seemed like something went wrong. I mean, kind of escape the fact that something's gone wrong, at society as it is today. And yet, when we trace it back, we end at this point, well, it doesn't seem as though it could have gone any other way.
Yeah. Yes. And, you know, that's why Nietzsche someplace, you know, described our species. He called it the disease called man. And it's an odd way of thinking about it, and it's certainly counterintuitive and, in fact, crassly reprehensible to the average person, because we're accustomed to seeing human beings as kind of the ultimate destination towards which all life has been evolving. But we're the only ones that made it, when, in fact, Another way of seeing it is that, you know, we're an unfortunate aberration of relatively recent origin that, as you put it earlier, will hopefully peter out at some point and let the rest of the natural world proceed in our absence.
Well, I don't feel that way about human beings, though. This is where I say this problem arises. Like, how can I identify the difference between what I do hope will peter out and what I don't? Like, an uncultured human, a human who hasn't been socialized and cultured, as you point out, seems to be impossible. It would just be a feral being that was completely cut off from his fellows. But maybe that's... I mean, it has to do with the fact that we just can't imagine anything different because it's so deeply embedded in us. I would say it comes to trauma. I mean, that's the best I can come up with. Something went wrong, and it had to do with a traumatic formative experience for the species, never mind us as individuals, that meant that that development of a social identity was defensive and was essentially hostile, was got stuck in the reptilian fight or flight mode. Yeah. So then the whole, everything we created around it became like this great destructive machine that basically just has to devour everything in order to feel safe.
No, well put. And I muse about this, but that raises, you know, kind of the chicken egg question about, well, what next? I mean, which has to come first? Do we have to, we meaning humans writ large, have to have the audacity to imagine a culture that's not fundamentally defensive? And if we did that, would the socialization process be altered accordingly, producing not radically altering human nature, but veering it in a different direction, let's say? Or, you know, does a different form of human have to arise first, perhaps in a relatively unenculturated environment, and then do somewhat different people who grow up under a radically different kind of socialization process, is that the necessary precursor to the kind of cultural changes that I was blubbering about a moment ago? I don't know, or does it have to happen a little of each?
Yeah. Well, not to get sidetracked on the whole other thing, but that's my interest in and take on autism. And I see myself as on the spectrum too, but much more high functioning, but this is a natural response or shift or mutation or whatever we want to call it within the species towards an uncultured, relatively pristine kind of psychic state. But the price of this is that the more pristine these individuals emerging through the species are, the less socialized, the more we just think they're retards and lock them away or try and use adverse behavioral therapy to correct them and, you know, make them fit in the square holes of society. So they're actually demonized and seen as something utterly undesirable. You know, the society itself won't allow for that emergence.
Right.
So then it's like to create environments in which it is safe to actually be unsocialized. I do that at an individual level, and we all to some extent try and create our own environment, but generally the desire is to fit in. There's just such a very strong desire to be socially acceptable that we will compromise, I think, our own inner sense of what's a healthy environment for us to exist in.
That's right.
So then we're dependent on the culture and society, and then that feeds it and that keeps it going. So, I would say there's the option of withdrawal is very key, in that autists are individuals who are born withdrawn, or they, at some level, they remain withdrawn.
Right.
They refuse to take the implant of culture, which I think actually relates to language in some way. And I say this could be a whole side conversation if we let it take control, but. How language, how culture uses language as a virus to embed itself in us. Joseph Chilton Pearce wrote about this. I don't know, do you know his work?
Yes.
And that affects our body, like that. He showed findings how language actually embeds in the body, so we develop at a very young age bodily tics, if you will, that correspond with words and phrases and what have you. So it's kind of like Reich's body armor, perhaps, and that language actually distorts our physical expression or controls it. And autists, of course, the low-functioning autists don't learn language, they don't verbalize. So I think it's kind of like there's a subspecies that's resistant to the culture, is my kind of interpretation of that, for whatever it means, I mean, whatever it implies for the future, I don't know.
No, good point.
But anyway, yeah, that is a whole other topic. I want to go back to the brow thing, and I'm going to describe to you how I interpret it. I actually didn't care for the book that much, because I found that all the good stuff was what Brower had done, and it was kind of there in the intro, and then the rest of the book didn't really seem to add a great deal to it. But
I happen to agree with that. You're right, the most compelling part of it was the first few pages, and the rest of the chapters seemed meandering and peripheral for me too.
And it seemed like the model, whatever you want to call it, the insight that Brower had really could do with some unpacking, and that didn't happen. So yeah. Which can be a good thing too, because it means that we can unpack it ourselves. So here is how I unpacked it anyway. It's relation to the origin of the mind. So self-deception and the origin of the mind, right? And this also relates to autism, because I think that Brower brought in the idea of theory of mind into his model now.
Yes.
Which is the idea that we can imagine what another person is thinking.
Yes.
And autists, notoriously, or whatever, I mean, according to the sort of official diagnosis, autists lack theory of mind. That's one of the tells about autists. And small children, of course, lack theory of mind also. They think that everything they're aware of, everyone else is aware of, just because they don't have this concept of somebody else having another mind or a mind at all. So what I got from Brower's thing was that theory of mind was necessary at a certain point for us as a species, for strategic survival things, as in we needed to anticipate what the other organisms might do, other human beings might do, and so then that introduced this need for hypothesizing, for imagining, oh, they might go left, or they might do this, or they might try and steal my vegetables, or they might attack my wife, and that this kind of imaginative process whereby we develop theory of mind itself was at the root of mind itself, as in when we could imagine the other, what the other might think, we ourselves started to think. So you know, it's a sort of tautological thing, it's a bit circular, but that the inception of mind corresponded with theory of mind.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. And actually I've communicated with the Varkey, the guy who worked with Brower, and I think that's a great point. And it's actually not a new one. Nietzsche made that point in The Gay Science, you know, long before we thought about theory of mind. He hypothesized that consciousness arose in an effort to make sense of other people's behavior. And yeah, I like that, and I buy that argument.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, I was saying, to bring it, when you're looking at the social level, the complexity of it, and the layers, and just how long it's been going on, and just how many people, I mean, the scope of it all, it becomes overwhelming. But I think it can be brought down to biology and psychology. That's
right.
My feeling. Those two things, the body and the psyche.
Yes.
It seems to me that all the mysteries are there.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like, I mean, I feel like we're working on a problem now, but not, I don't see it as a social problem, I suppose. I see it as like an individual thing. Like, for me, I'm stuck in these same complexes that have created the very culture that we're so dissatisfied with. They're actually running my hard drive too.
Yes.
So it feels as though the primary goal is to understand how that virus, if you will, cultural virus, has taken over my hard drive, and is there a way to remove it, or at least maybe just understanding it neutralizes it, do you think?
Yes.
So that sort of turns the whole thing around for me. Like, it seems that when you look at, we were talking at the beginning about the negative and focusing on the problem, it seems to me if you really look at the problem and see the negativity for what it is, you see that it's not actually a problem. It's a form of a solution, in that you're seeing the way that the system has been compromised, and therefore you're seeing what the system is and how it actually wants to work.
Yeah. And I like that. So that's a nice way of extricating ourselves from what might otherwise be perceived, as a hopeless situation. And by the way, I'm reading Nietzsche for the gazillionth time. I'm looking at his All Too Human. And, you know, that he, in the beginning of the book, says, well, that's what philosophy is about, is being able to recognize what's happening, and in so doing, at least to offer yourself as an individual, very inspired and positive ways to respond. And so you're right, I don't think this need end badly for each of us as individuals.
What's that, offer oneself as an individual? Is that the phrase that Nietzsche used?
Well, I'm going to have to re-look at it. You know, for one thing, I'm reading him in translation, but I think it was something along the lines of his pointing out that it was his, you know, kind of passionate defense of the importance of philosophy, not so much as an academic discipline, but as a tool that individuals could use to, bring the best out in themselves. He called them free spirits.
Yeah. Huh. I got this sort of image of offering oneself up. I suppose is it to do with embodying the very things that one is discovering, perhaps?
Yeah.
So the one is walking and not just talking.
That's right.
That seems to be the thing that actually makes the difference now.
Yes, I think so.
Do you need to get going?
Oh, yeah, I actually do today, Jason. I forgot about the time.
That's funny, because we began about time, and I was going to ask you about eternity. It was going to be my last question. Could I get it out real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have this position about eternity, which is that it's not a mystical concept, and that when we talk about death, we're really talking about eternity, and that there's nothing mystical about that. But people sort of look at me funny when I say that. Do you feel that eternity is a mystical concept?
To be silly, I'm going to have to get back to you. I've been I can't remember what book I'm reading called Death, Time, and Eternity. That may be a chapter in the Norman Brown book. And I'm supposed to give a talk next year in Copenhagen about the notion of time and eternity in light of our ideas. And I just haven't made much progress here. I'm reading a book called Einstein's Dreams. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's been around a while, which is just a consideration of the nature of time in light of his ideas about relativity. And if I understand that book, which I don't yet, then, yeah, I think eternity need not. I do consider it a mystical concept, but that's a stance that I hope to overcome, because I think that it has naturalistic connotations.
Yeah, well, I think like infinity, you know, is a necessary hypothesis for mathematics. It seems as though eternity has a similar kind of necessity to it.
Yes.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind.
For more information about terror management theory, go to the link in the show notes, tmt.missouri.edu. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so in various ways. including donating at the blog or at patreon.com/liminalist, or join the discussion at kubicon.com/maze.
La fille dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Des lèvres, l'air de bois, tout pose des problèmes. Les songes sur les arbres préparent.